Rachel Larby, Real Aid.
UNHCR were very, very well organised in the Tanzanian camps. They had asked different agencies to be responsible for different aspects of care for the refugees. And they had extremely good people at the heads of each department setting this up. So there was no real duplication of work, and each agency knew clearly what its role was and what it was responsible for. And Tearfund, who I worked for, was in an alliance with another British NGO called Christian Outreach. And we were responsible in Lumasi camp for curative healthcare, and in Musuhura Hill camp, a camp of about 80,000, for community services, and in both of those two camps for a construction program for primary schools. So we had a sort of threefold program, and I was in charge of the curative health. Now that meant in Lumasi camp that we had one hospital, three outpatients clinics, and one feeding centre for malnourished children. I was the coordinator, so that's the manager of the programme, which meant I didn't really have a great deal of hands-on experience working with the refugees, but I was in charge of managing the programme, pardon me, administratively, and managing the team of expatriates and refugee staff and Tanzanian staff who worked underneath me. We had one expatriate doctor and five expatriate nurses and an expatriate logistician and myself. As well as that, we had employed within the camp to work in the hospital and the clinics and the feeding centre a large number of refugee staff, about 400 of them. Many of them weren't particularly highly trained. Traditionally, in Rwanda, the Tutsis had been the educated people and the Hutus had been the country people. Again, that's a real generalisation, but these things have to be made. So most of the workforce in the camp was not particularly highly educated. A lot of them were country people, farm people. But willing to learn and willing to help to rebuild their shattered community within the situation of the camps. So we had a lot of people wanting to come and help and work as volunteer nurses in our clinics and hospital. Obviously they got paid a small amount of money as well, so that was an incentive to come and work, but it wasn't by any means very much money. We didn't choose how much money we paid them. UNHCR set down guidelines for different levels of refugee staff and how much should they be paid. And they were paid in Tanzanian shillings. Not very much, but it was all pocket money. The people lived in huts that they'd built themselves. UNHCR provided plastic sheeting, the ubiquitous plastic sheeting, when the people fled across the border. They'd brought with them what they could, their belongings that they could carry, that their children could carry. They came on foot, mostly, and almost all of them. I mean, people didn't have cars. Very, very few would have had vehicles or any other means of transport. So they came on foot with whatever they could carry. Pots, pans, clothing, some books, whatever was a treasured possession. And their little huts that they made were tiny little blendes, they're called, which is, I guess that was the Rwandan word, Kinyarwandan word. And they would also use bits of branches, leaves, mud brick, if they could, to enhance their little structure. And then try to perhaps grow a few beans around their little plot. Land wasn't a problem. They weren't really overcrowded in these camps because there's quite a lot of space. It's a very rural part of northwest Tanzania where there wasn't anything else before. So there is quite a lot of space, but the Tanzanian government won't let them go much further now than they already are. So there is, you know, each little blende has, you know, quite a few sort of feet around it before the next one. So they're not living on top of each other as the Vietnamese boat people in the Hong Kong camps were, but they can't really spread any further into Tanzania because there's a limit to the amount, to the extent that the camps are allowed to be. Tanzanian government's also put a limit on cultivating land around, because if they give them too much land to cultivate, then the refugees will just get stuck in and settled and become another part of the population, and they want it to be still, you know, a migrant transitory population who will go back, and you can't blame them for that, really. The Tanzanian government really has been remarkably amenable and helpful in allowing the refugees to stay, particularly if you compare it to the Zairean government, where the refugees fled the other way, and they are now being, many of them, forcibly repatriated or victimised by the Zairean army to encourage them to return. So the Tanzanian lot have really had it quite easy in that respect. UNHCR, through the World Food Programme, provides food, and they get rice and beans, maize flour, some oil. And that's okay, it's okay to live on, although a lot of the refugees don't really like it. They would like bananas, because that's what they would have grown before and lived off in Rwanda. So those that have jobs save their money and try to buy bananas or meat to supplement their diet. They get enough food to keep them going. When I left, it was 1,900 calories a day per person. Now, that's enough to keep losing weight on. But there is surplus food around, as I say. People who've got money can buy it. People who haven't got money can exchange it for what they have got. So there's a sort of market within the camps that goes on. There's a sort of bartering system service. And generally, the malnutrition rate is not actually worse than it was in Rwanda, or worse than the local non-refugee population of Tanzania. The malnutrition rate is below 2% severe malnutrition. So it's not as dire a picture of refugees now as perhaps it could have been when the mass exodus occurred, or as we have seen in history before now. The main problem is its sheer size, enormous numbers of refugees, and that we're no further to finding a political situation. Rwanda is now half empty, it's only got Tutsis, and Zaire and Tanzania have got huge refugee populations on their hands. The refugees don't want to go back, they're afraid that the Tutsis will kill them, and the Tutsis say, yes, we'll kill them if they come back, if they're guilty. If they're innocent, we won't kill them. But they also say, if they fled, then obviously they're guilty. So the longer the situation goes on, the more difficult it is for the refugees to go back, because by the very fact that they're in exile is proving to the Tutsi population back at home that they're guilty. And who's to say who's guilty and who's not guilty anyway? Yes, it was a genocide, but when you talk to the individuals concerned about their part in it, or what they saw, or what they did, or what they heard, what they witnessed, they all say that there was just mass killing going on, and people were forced to kill. Some people killed because they wanted to kill, and they were incited and hated and killed, but others were forced to kill. And if you were a woman who is faced with a choice to kill your children or kill somebody else's, you'd kill somebody else's. Or if you were forced with kill or be killed, you may well kill. None of us know what we would do in a situation like that. And as with all these situations, it's not so black and white when you get down there and find the facts on the ground. And I would look at some of our staff in a hospital, people who I came to trust and to know and to love, and think, I wonder what you've done, or I wonder what you've seen. And it's very, very hard to judge people when you really don't know what they've been through. So it's very complex and difficult. The other thing is that many of the women and children could probably go back, because many of the women and children were innocent victims. But they won't go back without their menfolk. And in fact, if they want to, nor would their menfolk let them go back without them. Because if the women go back, it's a bit like sorting the sheep and the goats. Then who is left? Well, it's the ones who are really guilty and bad that are left. And so there is a certain amount of terrorisation within the camps, that those who want to go back are prevented from going back by their own evildoers within their community, because they are protected, as it were, safety in numbers, and safety in numbers of the innocent women and children and innocent families who are there protecting the guilty ones. Now, all the aid agencies have to leave the camps at dusk. So that's at about 6 o'clock. We get out. And then apparently I hear from our staff that the camps become a very different place. There is military activity that takes place. People are trained up. The leaders are rounding up youngsters in the camps to support the cause. And the idea is to go back into Rwanda and take over a control. This is much worse, I gather, in Zaire. The camps in Zaire have become real recruiting grounds for the military to return to Rwanda. In Tanzania, it all happens on a much smaller scale, but it happens. And we don't know much about it. We are not there. And we're not there because it's not really safe to stay in the camps after dark. There are weapons, for sure. I don't know where they come from, but there are some weapons. We had one or two incidents when international staff were threatened, not because of what we're doing, but because they're grateful for what we're doing, but because there was a time when the money was reduced and the food supply pipeline was slowing down, and we actually had to reduce the daily ration to 900 calories, which isn't very much. It was only temporary, and then food started coming again. But obviously the refugees were angry and upset, and they take it out on the nearest people. And so there was an incident in our camp when a hand grenade was thrown at one of the international agency vehicles, and mercifully, nobody was killed. But they could have been, and that might have been very different. So it's for our own protection that we have to leave the camps at dusk.
It would seem from what you're saying that if a lot of the refugees went back, the civil war would start again.
Oh, yes.
In as much that they're being trained up, you know.
Oh, I believe it would, yeah, absolutely. Mm. And they want it too. I mean, if you talk to any of these leaders, they are angry. They are furious that they're not allowed to be in their own country. And they desperately want to go back to their country. And because they're too afraid to go back peacefully, because they think they'll be killed, the only way they can go back is to go back forcefully and with war on their minds. Yes, they want more war. And that's very sad, because the attitudes then have not changed. They're still there. And the same attitude exists in Rwanda. I was lucky enough to go to Rwanda twice to see for myself what the situation there is like. And that's, as I say, how I know they say if they're innocent, they can come back. But they're not innocent, because they wouldn't be there in the first place if they were innocent. And then the mood will change and they'll say, but if they do come back, we'll kill them or we'll fight them. And they hate each other. There is no feeling of reconciliation in the air at all. And you can't have peace until you've got reconciliation. And they fuel upon it. It's fed upon by remembering the bloodshed. Everybody will recount to you the horror stories of what they've seen, because they don't seem to wish to eradicate it or erase it from their minds. They want to remember it. And they do remember it and harbour grievances against the others for a long time.
Were there any cases you were told of, you know, explicitly? Can you remember?
Stories, you mean? Yes, when I mentioned about a woman who said she had to kill someone's children or have her own killed. It wasn't exactly for her, this woman who was a member of our staff, it wasn't exactly like that, but she had the opportunity, she had some neighbours' children with her, the opportunity to choose between which children would die, her children or her neighbours' children. And she chose her neighbours' children to die. Now, show me a woman who wouldn't. How can we judge? But she herself is judging herself. She herself is living with the guilt of that and the grief. And she feels that she should be punished for that. She's certainly punishing herself, because she feels that she stood by and did nothing to stop her neighbour's children being killed, because she knew that if she didn't, her own would be killed. And she now says, but I should have prevented them, you know, I should have done something. And who are we to say what we would or wouldn't have done in such a situation? I can hold no blame over her, absolutely none. There must be many, many incidences like that. And many people said they pleaded to be killed themselves, to be killed themselves rather than to have their children killed or to be forced to kill someone else. But the mood of the place was such disgusting hatred and perversion that they weren't allowed to have that choice, that people would put machetes into their hand and told to cut someone else's hand off or to cut their head off or do something, or else they would have their own cut off. I mean, I can see why they did it. They just had to do it. They had no choice. Other people said they would plead to be shot cleanly in the head rather than be killed with a machete. And people would pay. That was another story. They would pay whatever money they had to be shot cleanly rather than to be hacked to death. And the atrocities, they're beyond belief, actually. Yeah, they're so difficult to imagine. And I wasn't there. I haven't witnessed them. I didn't see it. So I can't really understand. And that's why I can talk about it so much more dispassionately, perhaps, than I can talk about Bosnia, because I was there in Bosnia. I was there while the war was going on, and I saw people at the time of the conflict, and I lived there with them through it, and I identified much more strongly. That's not to say I don't feel compassion for the Rwandan refugees. Of course I do. You can't fail to when you're there. But I can't feel it quite so deeply and so passionately as I can identify with the people in Bosnia.
You mentioned earlier, you know, the fact that they were so sort of Western and modernised, the Bosnians. Is that a factor, do you think, that you could identify, empathise?
Yes, it is. It obviously is. I mean, when you see a limb in the street that's a white limb with a pair of jeans on it, it affects you far, far more, me, than an African limb lying there with ragged clothes, because it's like it could be my brother, it could be my neighbour, it's somebody who is like me. The same with the mothers that I saw in Bosnia whose sons were soldiers or prisoners, or they didn't know where their sons were. They could be any one of my relatives. But the whole African culture is so far removed from anything that I have experienced as my own that I can't identify with it so strongly. That's not to say I can't work in it, and maybe it makes you able to work more effectively in a way because your emotions aren't involved. I got very emotionally involved in Bosnia, and I'm not ashamed of it. It also tired me out so much more because it was emotionally draining. In Tanzania, the major crisis was over, the massacre was over, the refugees are just an ongoing problem. But it wasn't so emotionally draining. Yes, it was physically tiring. We worked long and hard hours. But I didn't feel completely drained at the end of the day the same way.
From what you were saying, though, it seems that there's no solution, that these people, you know, whatever happens, the refugees, the majority of Rwandans are outside of Rwanda, and it's very difficult for them to be repatriated. Does this make you frustrated as a relief worker with no sort of political power?
Well, yes, it makes me frustrated because I can't see a solution to the problem. I don't think it makes me frustrated because I haven't got political power, because I think even the people with political power don't know what to do in this situation. So I'm very glad that it's not my choice, it's not my decision. My work is there and it's clearly mapped out and I can do it. Their job is much harder, the people who are there to decide what do we do next. I think for the refugees in Tanzania it's a slightly easier problem, because the Tanzanian government is not so hardline as the Zairean government, and there is talk that they might move the refugees further inland, break them up into smaller groups and have more resettlements in smaller camps further into Tanzania. That's a possibility. The refugees don't really want that because it's not their country and they want to go back, but that might be the lesser of the two evils. that's the better option. In Zaire, they haven't got that option at all. If they try to move further into Zaire, they'll just be rounded up by the military and forced back. And not just forced back to the camps, but forced back across the border into Rwanda. So that's the problem that's much more pressing, really. And I don't have any answers to that one, and I don't know who does.
But I was wondering, you know, when you were explaining about the militias being formed in these camps, which you felt you had to leave at night, whether, you know, that made you sort of frustrated, that this was going on and obviously was not a helpful thing to the ultimate solution. What, you know, what is the answer to that? Can the relief agencies play any role when that's going on under their noses?
Yes. I think there's very little you can do about that. I think the major role for the relief agencies, and it's a pretty hard task, is to provide communication links between the Tutsis in Rwanda and the Hutus in the neighbouring countries, and that only through reconciliation can there be any form of peace and resolution to this. You know, that sounds a bit like pie in the sky, because the Hutus and the Tutsis have been at loggerheads for years and years and years, and it's not just going to change overnight. But the only way that it can happen is through mutual forgiveness, I think. And they have to realise and recognise that there have been atrocities on both sides, that nobody is blameless, and that you have to put your own personal grief and hatreds behind you and say, we're going to start again and we're going to live together. Now, it's so easy for me to say that, isn't it? Because I haven't lost a single member of my family to another ethnic group, and I don't hate in the way that they hate, and I don't have the grief and the loss to come to terms with that they've got. But it seems to me it's the only possible solution. And I suppose, as a Christian, and this is where my faith comes in, you believe that that sort of thing can happen because God can make people love and allow forgiveness and change people. People have to change. They have to have a change of heart and a change of mind and a change of attitude. And I can see that happening in individuals, because that's what does happen when people change and they recognise that there is a God and there's a God of love. But to have enough faith to believe that that's going to happen for a million people is a lot, but you have to believe it. Otherwise you'd give up, I think.
Were there any sort of agencies in the camps looking for war criminals in the Rwandan sort of civil war?
Yes, that's a very good question. There weren't agencies specifically looking for war criminals. However, through UNHCR, under which we were all working, we were asked to supply lists of staff, refugee staff we had working for us, with their names, their family background, their mother's name, their father's name, which sector, cellule and commune they came from, which is the actual area, village and place of identifying them. A lot of personal information about our staff, and these lists were then to be compared with lists produced by the current Tutsi Rwandan government in their search for war criminals. Now, as agencies, to a man, we decided we could not do that. That was not on, and we refused. And this debate and discussion was very much ongoing as I was about to leave. And I've heard now that UNHCR have dropped it altogether and have said, OK, you don't need to supply that information, because we just did not feel that we could be liaising with the current Rwandan government, who might have lists from all sorts of sources. I mean, who is to verify the information on their lists? And we're not going to be party to that kind of thing. And I was surprised that UNHCR were, but then perhaps I shouldn't be surprised, as I said, from what I'd learned about UNHCR before. I think they were in a difficult situation because the Ministry of Home Affairs in Tanzania also wanted information about who was employed, and that's understandable because it's their country and they need to have information like that. But that should not in any way be tied with giving information to the Rwandan government. So we fortunately got out of doing that one, and it's not being pursued.
So where next? What are your plans now? Are you wanting to go off again, you know, into the relief field?
Yes, very much. I know now that this is what I meant to do, and I'm very, very happy and fulfilled in it. Every single place that I've gone to, really, I've left reluctantly, apart perhaps from Tanzania, and I think that was because I wasn't so closely involved with the people. I was much more of a manager, and I guess what happens the higher up you get in relief worker terms. I'd go back to Bosnia tomorrow if I could. I think the situation there was just so interesting, and I got so involved, and it's ongoing, and I think there's a lot more to be done and to happen there. But I feel actually at the moment that I need to spend some time in this country, just resting for one, and two, probably doing a master's degree in development studies or some kind of relief and development field to get a further academic qualification before I work again with a relief agency.
Why do you feel the need for that?
Twofold, really. One is that basically you're asked for it nowadays. Most of the international organisations and the UN want to take people with further and further qualifications in their field, and so to get a better job, I need a job with more responsibility, I need to have the qualification. And two, I do think it is actually important to understand the theories behind conflicts that are emerging and conflicts that have emerged in the 20th century, and living in today's world, to know more about the in-depth politics behind these incidences and how they affect the individual's lives. It's the individual's lives that I'm there to work with, because that's what I enjoy. But I think I need to have a greater understanding of the whys and wherefores of these situations that arise.
Mm-hmm. What do you think you've gained most from the years you've been doing, you know, these four very important arenas you've been involved with?
Oh, it's changed me tremendously. I'm much, much, much more content at home when I come back. And much more relaxed and laid back, really, because I think I've seen where my true priorities lie, what's important and what's not important. And an awful lot of things that we get bothered with here aren't important, actually. We have life, we have health, basically, and we have freedom. And beyond that, and with all those things come, you know, warmth and security and food and money and the ability to travel. And beyond that, we don't miss anything. We have so much, and that's what really, really matters. The little things just don't matter anymore. So when I come home now and I have a hot bath and I get into a clean bed and warm sheets, it's just like the ultimate luxury. I don't take anything for granted that I used to, and so I don't get distressed by little trivial things. And I appreciate my family and my friends so much more, because I realise that I might not have them if I lived elsewhere in the world. I appreciate my freedom. And I've also changed in that I'm much more outward looking globally. And as I said before, I think I've always been quite interested. But now I read the international pages and the news probably before I read the external pages. I listen to things that are happening all around the world. I'm very interested in what's been going on in Chechnya. I haven't been there. Maybe I'll be there next. Suddenly the world seems to have opened up, and I think it's made me much more broad-minded.
Well, Rachel, thank you very much indeed for telling me in such detail about your relief experiences. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.